We're back to the Neil Haley Show here on the Caregiver Dave Celebrity Segment on the Sullivan Program. My good friend, Caregiver Dave and Sandy Dave, how are you? What's up, man?
I'm awesome. Waiting for my movie to come out. My book's already out. We're just having a great time riding the wave.
And my guest today, Ed Hagem, is just one of the most amazing stories. I just want him to tell his story. And I was talking about if the pursuit of happiness can have a movie about a financial guy that's moved up the financial ladder, this guy's rag to riches story is amazing. Kidnapping, from kidnapping to a Harvard business school grad to successful in so many ways, Ed Hagem. Ed, thanks for stopping by. How are you?
Thanks for having me. It's a great thing to be on your show.
Absolutely. So let's talk about this story. Let's just start at the beginning. And I know Dave will ask questions, but the best way to do it is you were kidnapped and it changed your life right at a very ripe old age, right?
Right. At age 3, mom and dad got divorced. And that's a long story. Dad was very successful in the 20s, lost everything between 29 and 33. It marked him for life. And as he tells the story, in 1933, sitting in New York, having lost his airplane, his buildings, his money, and his mother died, he decided that between committing suicide and driving to California. Lucky for me, he decided to drive to California, or I wouldn't be here now. Anyway, he stopped at a cousin's house. He married, after 2 weeks, he married the fifth of a six-child family and drove off to California after 2 weeks of being with this family. She was a very young woman. She was only 18 when they got married. He was 33.
Wow.
And difficult character, having lived a very difficult life. He had still some of the Middle Eastern mentality of like the Hajj, Abraham in the Hajj. He had very definite habits, and you know, women are not supposed to work and so on. So anyway, so in 1936, I was born 3 years after marriage, and 3 years later, my mother couldn't take it anymore and she got divorced. She got custody, went back to St. Louis from Los Angeles. My father got visiting rights on Sunday and $5 a week in alimony and child support. And kind of the first Sunday, he drove the 1800 miles from Los Angeles to St. Louis, picked me up, and basically instead of taking me to the park or to a movie, got back on Highway 66, that's on the front cover of the book, and drove me back to Los Angeles, told my mother not to look for us, and told me a couple times later, he said basically she died. And I live with the fact that she died for a very long time, actually 57 years. That's how it all started. And, at age 3, I obviously didn't recognize what that all meant, but this started a 15-year period of hotels and motels until my father got drafted to the Second World War, then five Catholic foster homes, then a trip back to New York. My father got out of the service, spent the summer of 46 in the YMCA on 34th Street, then a hotel room in Coney Island, and Dad went back to sea, and I ended up with two orphanages until I graduated high school. That's a thumbnail experience. The foster homes were, the first one was Dickinsonian. They were interested only in the money. They were cold and aggressive and really abusive in many respects. The homes kept getting better. And by the last one, which was only 6 months, they turned out to be warm and caring. So I got the full range of experiences. I was in five Catholic schools as well. I think that's one of the greatest trainings of all time. Not only did the nuns teach me a great deal, but going from one schoolyard to the other, you learn an awful lot. And I learned a lot by having to adjust to a different environment on a regular basis. That's a thumbnail of it. I could spend some time on the detail, and just throw in the fact that I didn't weigh, at age 11, I weighed 66 pounds and I was 4 feet six. So it wasn't exactly a kid that could get along too well in the schoolyard. I learned how to adapt.
All right. Dave, wow. A question for you, Dave. Go ahead.
So when did you realize that you had a story and that you were going to write about it?
Well, when I was 18 years old and I was graduating from high school, I was very much embarrassed. I didn't want any benefit from my background. So what I tell young people today, and it's a little different than it is now because, poor kids or kids from orphanages didn't go to private colleges. So when I left Yonkers, Roosevelt High School in Yonkers, went to the University of Rochester, I decided to bury my background. My father was a merchant marine. He was at sea. We lived in a post office box in San Francisco. My mother died when I was 3. End of story. So what some people say, a little bit of denial doesn't hurt. And I denied it. So I didn't have to explain it to everybody. I didn't get any you know, benefit. I didn't want, I was ashamed of it. I didn't want anybody to give me any special privileges for my background. And I buried it until my early 70s. My wife knew most of it. I told her before we got married. My kids knew about half of it. And I basically lived my life, you know, of this particular situation. My early 70s, my wife and my children ganged up on me, along with the University of Rochester, where I was the chairman, said, we got to know more about your background. So I actually couldn't write my childhood. My daughter, who is a writer and is a curator at TED Talks, wrote the first draft of my background. I kept every letter my father had written me, and he had kept every letter that I wrote him. So I had all that documentation. You had to separate the, you know, from facts from what I remembered. You had to basically get that thought you wanted to communicate. Once you got that thought down on paper, was the reader going to get that thought? Anyway, my daughter wrote my first draft of my background. I couldn't actually tell the story I just told you because I would well up. All those background things would come back. Even at my age, I really couldn't handle it because I buried it. It was buried away, and I thought I would never tell the story. Anyway, so I wrote the first book, and I sent the galleys out. And I said, these 15 people came back, and half of them said, you know, you've got it. There's a wider audience for this. Every freshman in college, every senior in high school ought to read this, because it proves that anything is possible in America. And education is at least the solution to almost everything, if not everything. It also had lessons in it. Like, in many respects, I look back on my background, and I learned from writing the book that, you know, I was never a victim. And I tell people, don't be a victim.
Right.
No matter what you do, whether it's right or wrong, and you end up having a bad situation, you know, go forward. Take that energy of being a victim and use it on what's next. I mean, I use the example of Lehman Brothers. I spent 7 years there, and I'm immodest in saying I did a great job on two very difficult divisions. The second one, I raised almost $8 billion in 2.5 years, and I still got thrown out because I wouldn't agree with the boss who was pushing out the chairman. I wouldn't push the chairman out, so he pushed me out. But instead of using that energy to fight him, which I could have gone to the press. I was the chairman of 7 mutual funds. I could have, you know, like outside boards. I went on to the next step, and I found my dream job. So I always tell people, try not to be a victim, whether it's your fault or not, go on to the next thing, because using energy on things that have passed is really a waste of time and energy.
Exactly.
So that's sort of that's why I decided to print it. And I'm getting a terrific kick out of it. I mean, I've lived my life on Wall Street under the mantra that to live happy is to live hidden. In fact, I used to tell people that publicity in the financial business is the next step before jail. So I stayed out of the press. I was the chairman, and I was a strategist and all that kind of stuff. And the CNBC would call me, and I'd always turn them down. Even when I sold the firm, they called me and I said, how about tomorrow morning? And they said, old news. So I sort of stayed out of the press and stayed out of television, because I felt like that's a whole different world. Now I'm in it. I'm talking to wonderful people like you, and I'm having a lot of fun with it. And it's absolutely helping people. I'm getting letters, and I'm getting emails from people telling me that they, you know, they really like the book. It's good reading. One woman said, it reads like fiction, but it's real life, which I thought was a great comment, you know. And I'm getting people associating with it.
That's great.
My life was like that. Here, my father was an orphan or some other damn thing like that. Right. Wonderful. Yeah.
All right. Go ahead, Dave. I know you have another question.
So any chance that this could turn into a movie?
Well, you know, as I said, my leading man died. Sean Connery's gone, unfortunately. But Tom Cruise, if he was interested, might be, you know. When I signed the contract, I got a big contract for signing this. Skyhorse gave me $1,000 and they took 90% of the revenues. But I did keep 50% of the movie rights. So we'll have to see. It would seem to me that, you know, with a little bit of, and you know, you have a little poetic license. You know, I met my wife when she followed me out to California. It's a great story, a long, wonderful story. She followed me out to California, and she was in graduate school there, and we dated, and I got married. Now, if I'd have met her in a smoky bar in San Francisco, and I saved her from a life of problems, you know, or saved her from a life of difficult situation, that might have made a better story. So, you know, maybe the
I think your story does. I think if you said you're inspiring people, I think it does. So I think you're undervaluing yourself on that. And I think Dave would completely agree with me as well, because the fact of the matter is, being from hotel to hotel, this is the kind of stuff that's on Netflix, right, Dave? This is the kind of stuff that's on Amazon, Dave, right?
Yeah,
and different things, because people want to see real, raw stuff. And so maybe you don't think your story is this.
No, the first foster home was abusive. They were really abusive. The guy used to take a strap out to me all the time. He didn't want to spare the child, and it wasn't wasn't quite Cinderella, but
it's,
you know,
it's the modern day Annie. It sounds wonderful.
No, and I remember one of the foster homes. I ran home from school because I was a small guy. Kids always beat me up because I was small, but I always fought back. And I remember this one woman, she said the bully was outside in the front yard. And I got home because I was really a fast runner. In fact, I ran track in college. I got home and I was breathing hard. And she says, "What happened?" I said, "The guys wanted to beat me. He's outside in the front yard." She says, "You go out there. You go out there." And I remember sending him back out there. And of course, I did one of those things. I ran back and ran into him, you know. And so I found out that if you hurt the other guy, even though you lose the battle, they leave you alone. So that was one of those lessons you learn. That isn't in the book, by the way. A lot of that background I left out because being in foster homes was enough. And, you know, I remember some things being a little guy really was important too. Lucky I grew about 6-7 inches in my sophomore and junior year in high school when I played basketball. So, I mean, it was another great experience of being an athlete and, you know, being a little guy, being an athlete. Baseball, they had to pitch to me because I wasn't such a big guy. You're right. I thought about the movie rights. I've been only working on the book for a year now. I want to find out where it's going, and it's opened up fabulous avenues for me. I'm involved with 72 foster kids in Boston now, with an organization that services those people. I'm involved at Northeastern University I'm training kids to handle, the freshman year. And these kinds of things are pretty exciting to me. I don't know anything about the movie business. I didn't know anything about the publishing business, by the way, either. So I'm learning, about this. I'm learning about talking to people like you. And, you know, I'm learning an awful lot about how to communicate. You know, I give the commencement speech at Brunswick School in Greenwich. I give the commencement speech. That's a real.
Don't worry, they're going to come to you asking for the movie. You don't have to go to them.
Exactly. That's what's going to happen, Dave. That's a great point. So Dave is a caregiver, and he has the final question for you, Dave.
Yeah, so I've been a caregiver for the last 25 years when it's about half of my marriage. Been married almost 50 years, and my wife had a headache of her life, wouldn't go away. It turned into a stroke. She lost her speech, paralyzed on one side, and overnight I'm a caregiver. And so, you know, the grief period, the next couple of years, figuring out how do we handle this, a lot of anger and denial, you name it. And so she reinvented herself finally, and our love was rekindled. And now I became Dave, the caregiver's caregiver. I speak all over the country. I've been on 53 TV interviews, and I help caregivers stay alive because 30% of them die before their loved ones do, with my website, caregiverdave.com. So I try to get the caregivers before they become caregivers, because everyone's going to eventually become one or need one. And so have you, at your ripe age of 80, I'm sure caregiving has touched your life somehow.
Well, you know, to me, you're doing exactly what for caregiving, what I'm trying to do for freshmen and sophomore freshmen college and freshmen seniors in high school, to get them through that difficult period. Because what you're saying is, if I can train you to be a caregiver, get you through that early stages, the grief and the anger. This, for example, foster kids, I tell them I had anger. I don't kid. I had, because when you're a foster child or an orphan, you keep saying to yourself, "Why me?" You spend your whole life saying that. You take that anger and place it outside, then you're dead. If you place it inside and use energy to go forward, you're okay. Same thing, with caregiving. Well, we have caregiving. We have Barbara and I, you know, right now at 85, every morning I have a prayer list, which is so goddamn long, it's ridiculous. I have 6 people with Alzheimer's now. You know, I have at least a half a dozen women with breast cancer that I communicate with as best I can. And in many respects, this is just support. I just talked to somebody who's going blind this afternoon. I said, "Emery, we're right behind you. The prayers are coming." You know, and so I'm not really a caregiver. I got 8 grandchildren, so I had enough of those kinds of problems. You got one of each, you know, and I have 3 children, of course. I'm married for 56 years, but I have a very healthy wife and a wonderful, wonderful relationship. But I always tell people I love her more than yesterday and less than tomorrow, because she's a very special lady.
I remember that song.
But the caregiving thing is, what you're doing is you're taking a different chunk of life. And that business, going from a regular person to a caregiver, you go through a time warp. Just like when people leave high school, go to college, something happens. And the way you handle that, kids don't flunk out of college academically usually. They flunk out socially. They get behind in the process, and they get down on themselves, and then they're out. you can get them over that, then you, and that's where I'm spending my, trying to spend as much of my time as possible. Also, people lose their job or get divorced, that sort of, that particular, you know, juxtaposition, try to get them into a different mentality. I mean, I got thrown out of Lehman Brothers. I mean, I still had kids in private school. I had, you know, a whole bunch of stuff, but I didn't. I said, all right, what's next? And then the next thing happened was absolutely fabulous. I mean, I gave up my fancy dining room for a conference room with two hot plates. I gave up my office, which overlooked the whole goddamn harbor, for an office which looked at a brick wall. But I found my dream job, which was to run a company. And I had a ball doing it for almost 20 years. So we had, you know, we really were very successful. But again, I tell people, you know, I was successful, but during that period of time that I grew the company 20 times, the market went up 10 times. So one of my pitches is, look at the world, try to get the wind at your back. Find, if you read all the biographies you want to read, you'll find out those people, most of the successful people, got some long period of their life where they had the wind at their back. And so these are the kinds of concepts that I'm coming up with. But the movie sounds great. If you could help me, I would be interested.
You're doing pretty good. You know, at 80, not many people.
85.
I'm 85. Excuse me. He's not looking 85.
You look like you're 60 and you talk like you're 60.
Yeah, exactly.
He's sharp as a tack. And so you're you know, one in a thousand. So just thank your lucky stars and thank God.
Oh,
since you're Lehman, since you got
kicked,
since you got kicked out of Lehman Brothers, I want to ask you, what's your opinion on cryptos?
Well, I've been negative on crypto from the beginning. My contention is that, no, by the way, Bitcoin's not going to go to zero.
No,
but in every market cycle, you get a speculation of some kind. You know, the E companies in 99. I go back to the oils and, you know, in the conglomerates in the 60s. There's always some wild speculation that occurs in every market cycle, and they take it down during the decline. I'll give you a simple example, which you'll all relate to. In 1999, early 2000, Amazon, which is a great company, sold at $100 a share. By the time that bear market was over, it sold at 10, or actually it went from 113 to 7. Now, I got corrected the other day when I used those numbers. But so Amazon was the sort of the poster child, and same thing with General Electric and Cisco. Those didn't come back. So this case, the crypto, the public got into it, everybody got into it, and they're gonna have to get back out again. But I think Bitcoin's here for a long time because of the fact, but it could be 10,000 easily by the time this is over. Because people like El Salvador and other places where the currency is actually weaker than Bitcoin. You know, I always kid about this, but the, you know, Vail, Colorado is just full of Mexicans. And the reason is that no Mexican has ever lost money by taking pesos and buying land or buying an apartment in Vail because the peso's gone down. And Argentinians the same way. So Bitcoin has that mentality. But the whole other crypto, Luna, which just went out of business, lost $50 billion. Mm. It was bigger than the Lehman Brothers disaster. But of course, it's 14 years later, and $50 billion is not
Look at Bitcoin. Some. All right. Best place we can find info on you. Purchase your book. Where can we go, Ed?
Pardon?
Where can we go to buy your book? What's the best place?
Oh, please do that. I appreciate it. More importantly, if you do read it, and only if you like it, go to Amazon, give us a little bit of a brief review and a rating. That's very important.
What's your website? It's available on Amazon, but you have a website?
You can go to my website, but on Amazon, you have to go and give me a review.
Okay.
205 stars, almost 205 stars.
All right, reviews. So where can we direct us to learn more about the book? Where can we go?
But my website or Amazon, both places.
What is your website so people know?
Yeah, Amazon does a pretty good job.
Where is your website for people to check?
Oh, it's easy. I'm the only Hagem in the world besides my kids. It's Ed Hagem, www.edhagem@gmail.com www.hagem.com.
All right, fantastic. We appreciate you, Ed. Dave, what an amazing guest, and I appreciate both of you.
Thank you.
All right, that was the Caregiver Dave Celebrity segment, guys. Take care.